VPR's membership drive is underway. We're asking you to make a contribution to help pay for this podcast and all the other programming you enjoy. Please give what you can at vpr.net. Thanks.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zandin for Jane Lindholm. Money, 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 money. There's no question many of us view the world through its prism, but Ben Hewitt doesn't seem like the kind of person who would have relationship problems with money. He lives on a farm and cabin and writes books about food, like The Town That Food Saved, about the local food renaissance in Hardwick. Still, when his savings and his livelihood took a hit during the economic crisis of 2008, Hewitt did lose sleep over money worries. And most of us would. But about that same time, he met a young man named Eric Gillard, whose way of living forced Hewitt to confront his attitudes toward money, his relationship with it, and larger questions about what drives our economy. Hewitt says his new book, Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World, is not so much about the rejection of money as it is a call to recognize the value of other relationships in our lives. So we'll ask him the question and ask you the questions. What do you think about our relationship with money? Do you think we have an overemphasis on it in our society? And if so, what do you do in your life to try to lessen your reliance on money and your relationship with it? Do you think Ben Hewitt's contention works in theory, but maybe isn't so practical? 1-800-639-2211 is our number here at Vermont Edition, or you can email us, vermontedition@vpr.net. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Ben Hewitt, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's great to be here.
So this idea that money's not the be-all, end-all, that's nothing new about that. The OJs sang about it. The Beatles did in Can't Buy Me Love.
Yeah, it's not exactly original thinking on my part.
And you even quote scripture from long ago, the quote, "For the love of money is the root of all evil." So is your message that, yeah, we believe all those things, but we behave differently?
I think that's partially true. I also think it's very true that the perhaps healthy and proper role of money in our society has, in a sense, that money has sort of exceeded the boundaries of what that role would be, and you know, become a thing. I don't see money as you sort of noted in your intro. I don't necessarily see money as being inherently good or evil. However, I do see it as being an incredibly powerful force, and I think our intent for it can be healthy or unhealthy.
So is, just to be clear on the kind of key message of your book, or one of them, is it that, gee, we don't really need, many of us don't need as much money as we think we need to lead happy and secure lives? Or is it just that, well, it's not that important how much you make, it's really your attitude that needs a readjustment, perhaps?
It's a little bit of each. I think it's clearly true that that many of us don't probably need as much money as we think we do. I would say more so, though, I think it is to be really aware of the extent to which our dependence on money fragments our relationships to other people and also to the natural world.
So flesh that out a little for
sure.
Us. Give us an example.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that money does really well, and I think money is it's a fantastic tool. I mean, it's an incredible convenience in a way, because it just provides us with such a sort of easy and sort of unaccountable or impersonal way of extinguishing debts. So if you were to purchase my book, for instance, if you hand me $25 for the book, which is the cover price, that relationship, your obligation to me has basically ended. And in some cases, that's a really convenient thing. You want that convenience in your life. I think what happens and what has happened is that the role of money has gotten to the point where it extinguishes more relationships than are perhaps healthy. And one of the things that really you know, I became one of the reasons I became so fascinated by Eric's life and the way he sort of conducted himself was that I saw in his life, you know, how the extent to which his relationships to other people in his community and also the natural world were just some of the deepest and most contented relationships I had witnessed. And a lot of that I really came to realize was because those relationships, you know, were dependent on what I sort of call in the book, I sort of call it the commerce of community or the currency of community. There was less of this dependence on this sort of, you know, the quick extinguishment of these debts through money.
Well, you've brought him up, and he is the central character in your book. You begin with a description of Eric and his life. Why don't you give us the thumbnail sketch of who Eric Gillard is?
Yeah, so the first thing, you know, that really drew me to Eric actually had nothing to do with money, and it had to do with the fact that, you know, I just quickly became aware when I met him that he was one of the most grounded, contented people, you know, I'd ever met. And I think most people have someone like that in their lives. You know, you just have this awareness of this person being sort of in their body and comfortable in the world and in their skin in a way that, you know, in some cases you might even be a little envious of. And, you know, since I've been out talking about this book in the region, I've run across numerous people who say, I know Eric, and that's exactly right. You know, he is like that. And so I had this awareness of this sort of level of sort of, you know, the extent of his sort of contentment and just the pleasure he took out of life before I even was aware of the particulars of his financial situation. And so when I did become sort of more cognizant of how money worked in his life, it led me to this place of like really wanting to sort of understand if there was a correlation, and if there was, what was the correlation? So, you know, the whole idea that money can't buy happiness is a cliche, perhaps even a platitude, you know, in our culture. But I wanted to understand, okay, is this contentment coming to him because somehow he's not using money to the extent that most of us are, or is he able to thrive in the absence of money because he's so contented? So kind of the horse or the cart type mm-hmm. of relationship there, and wanting to better understand that. And also, you know, at the same time, I was just becoming aware, as you mentioned, you know, my financial particulars were changing with the recession in a way that, you know, a lot of people are probably familiar with. And I was just becoming so keenly aware of what a dominant force money is and how I really did not understand it very well. You know, I didn't understand really where it came from. I didn't understand why it works the way it does, and why it seems to work so much better for some people than for others. And I certainly at that point, you know, didn't really understand the extent to which it had an impact on my relationships with other people.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned in the introduction that Eric is someone who earns less than $10,000 a year. He was building, at least at the time of the writing, a small structure in right. which to live.
Shack, shed,
eight
yes.
8x12 feet, which had no door at the time,
right.
I guess. But you also describe him, and you know, he's 29 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He is a healthy individual.
Right.
He lives in a rural setting where, you know, a certain amount of self-sufficiency is possible.
Right.
He's white.
Right.
He's got all these things going for
yes.
him in a way. And I think a lot of listeners would think back, older listeners would think back and say, yeah, that sounds kind of like me in my 20s. I get it. But, you know, when you're 30, 40 and beyond, mm-hmm. you don't see the world the same way.
I think that is partially true. And I have to say, you know, regarding all of the sort of privileges that you just sort of outlined, you know, Eric would be the first to agree with you. And I would be the first to agree that, you know, I have my own set of privileges, you know, being white, being English speaking, you know, maybe even because I'm heterosexual and male. And, you know, these are all sort of, you know, emulate positions, the people who are in positions of power in our society. And so I probably benefit from those in ways I don't even understand. So I think you're right that people will, you know, some people will say that and probably do say that. I've been incredibly struck over the past week going out with this book into the communities that have gone into them, and the people who have come out from all walks of life, including tremendous monetary affluence, who, you know, seem to have the themes of this book really seem to resonate with them, and they have a lot to say about it. And I guess I want to emphasize, you know, that I don't really see the book so much as being a rejection, about a rejection of money, as being an embrace of these other aspects of sort of the human experience. You know, that money just so happens, I think, sometimes it can really get between us and those aspects. So again, it's not, you know, I don't think you need to make a specific amount of money to sort of appreciate, you know, these facets of being alive on this wonderful world. And I don't think there's any particular lifestyle that is going to guarantee you that awareness.
Talking with Ben Hewitt, who lives in Cabot. He's the author of a number of books, most recently Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World, in which he examines his own attitudes toward money, his own relationship with money, and how that colors his other relationships, and invites us to do the same. And we invite you to call us with questions or comments for Ben Hewitt, 1-800-639-2211. We have a couple of comments. Ben, Andrea posted, living frugally and simply is very freeing for many people, and there are many things that are more important than some core basic level of income. I'm curious to know if people who live very modestly do so without any financial support or assistance from family, friends, and government when emergencies or healthcare needs come along. And I think that's really the first thing that springs to mind when we talk about our relationship with money and perhaps living more frugally, is not people scratching their heads and going, well, how am I going to afford, you know, the RV I want? They're really thinking about, what about an emergency or a crisis? How am I going to deal with it without money?
This is a huge subject, we could spend the rest of the show probably talking about it. One of the things, you know, a couple of people have sort of brought me to task over the context of talking about this, about Eric and this subject, and you know, and saying, you know, look, this is all well and good, but Eric is only living like this because, you know, he can depend on us sort of hardworking taxpayers to, you know, in essence, subsidize his life. I'm not sure that's exactly what Andrea is suggesting, but I think one thing that is really important to me to point out is that I think there are many ways for people to contribute to our society, some of which include money and some of which don't. And one thing that is very, very clear to me is that Eric contributes in very meaningful ways. He works with children and he contributes in very meaningful ways to the children and the families to which these children belong. And I've actually received emails, you know, since the book came out of people saying, you know, I'm so glad that you talk about this because Eric has made a profound difference in my child's life. So that issue, though, is a very difficult one to navigate. It's one of the things that, you know, my wife and I talk about it all the time because we have also, not to the extent that Eric has, but certainly to a pretty great extent, we live on about half the median income for a family of four, you know, have chosen an alternate path. And we do sometimes talk about what is it going to mean to grow old and, you know, possibly to not have the same level of savings we might have if we had devoted, you know, more of our adult working life toward earning money. The reality is it's a wonderful thing to talk about, you know, how money impacts us. But it's also important, I think, to acknowledge that we do live in a society where a lot of the means of our security are available to us only through money. I want to point out, it's a very conditional security, right? So the institutions that provide you with the healthcare and the food and all of these other aspects of your well-being and even survival, they're only going to give that to you if you have the money to give back to them, right? So it's in some ways, I don't want to say it's totally a false security, but it is a security that's built on something of an artifice. I mean, and this is particularly true when you sort of understand a little bit more of the mechanics of how money works.
We'll talk about that and get into more questions about the book after the break. Before we go to the break, one more comment that sort of echoes what Andrea had to say. This is from a listener who posted before the program and writes, "It sounds interesting, but if I made $10,000 a year, I couldn't pay for health insurance, which would be irresponsible towards my children and to society, which would pick up the bills for emergency room visits. Maybe I could barely pay a rent, but that wouldn't leave anything in the pot, and I certainly couldn't save anything for my children's education or for the days when I cannot work, which again would be irresponsible to my children." So that, as you pointed out, Ben, that's a very common reaction. And it's interesting that you're still grappling with it.
I am still grappling with it. And maybe after the break, we can address that in a little more detail.
We are talking about our relationship with money with Cabot author Ben Hewitt, whose new book is called Saved. We invite you to chime in at 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zinn for Jane Lindholm. Ben Hewitt says his book, Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World, isn't about creating a utopian moneyless society, but about returning money to its proper place. Hewitt says money has become an end to itself rather than a means to an end, and he writes about the personal economy, one that incorporates relationships to others, to the world around us, and to how we spend our time. I'd like to know what you think of what you've heard so far at 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Ben Brad and Newberry posted this, "We work and work and work just to earn money so we can pay other people to do things we could do ourselves. When we stay home more and do more, we can get by with a lot less money." Brad says, "I loved Ben's first two books. Can't wait to read this new one."
Hey, thanks, Brad.
So you mentioned, you know, at the outset in your book, you talk about Eric, and mm-hmm. you talk about 2008 and how work disappeared and retirement savings, a large chunk of it disappeared. Can you characterize then what your attitudes about money were then and
yes.
what they are now, given your experience with Eric and writing the book?
Yeah. I mean, my attitude around money at that time was almost entirely fear-based. And it came from a place of just, I think a lot of people can relate to this. It came from a place of always sort of being afraid that I wasn't going to have enough. Interestingly enough, you know, my financial situation has hardly changed since I started writing this book. I still make about the same amount of money. My income fluctuates a little bit because I'm self-employed, but it always seems to fall in this fairly narrow range. You know, the very piddling retirement savings that were cut in half are still cut in half because I did the exact wrong thing and basically liquidated everything at the bottom and have, you know, since been way too afraid to do anything but let it sit there. So nothing's really changed for me. With the exception that I no longer feel that same sense of fear and uncertainty. And I think that comes from a place of having more fully acknowledged that money is only one component of my well-being. It's only one component of my economy and of what makes me secure in this world. And as you know, as I sort of write in the book, I think what's happened is that for me and what I see in Eric is that as you sort of embrace these other aspects of, you know, if you want to call them wealth, that's fine, whatever term you want to use, there just simply is less room for money. And I'm talking about sort of more emotional, intellectual, maybe even spiritual room for money in your life.
There's some terms you use in the book, conscious and unconscious economy. Mm-hmm. Define
right.
them for us.
Well, the conscious, you know, the unconscious economy is, and to get back to that comment about sort of, you know, healthcare and all of these other sort of powerful forces in our life that are dominated by money, they're really all sort of rooted in the mentality of money. You know, those are all part of sort of what I sort of call, you know, the unconscious economy. And that's the economy that, you know, really in some ways discourages us to have this awareness around money. I mean, there is nothing profitable in us being discerning about how we use our money, in us having a particular intent for our money. There is no profit in that. And so we are encouraged to be unconscious. Never mind, you know, what the ubiquity of money does and the centralization of production does regarding the sort of externalized costs of all the goods that we consume. So that's, you know, in a nutshell, the unconscious economy. And the conscious economy is simply sort of that level of awareness that I'm talking about. And just, you know, having this perception and this real sort of level of discernment about the role of money in your life. And, you know, what are you when you're spending money? And I think about this a lot in my own life. You know, when I choose to spend money, which of course I do, my life is still very much tied to the monetary realm. You know, what am I saying yes to by spending that money? Not, you know, there's that cliche, you know, vote with your wallet or vote with your pocketbook. You know, but what, it's really true. You know, what are we agreeing to when we choose to spend money in a particular way?
Is there anything you would have said yes to before all of this and that you wouldn't say yes to now?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know that I can pinpoint one thing in particular, because as you noted in the intro, I already came at this, you know, a lot of what changed has been much more interior.
Yeah.
Because my income hasn't really shifted, I haven't made some like drastic life change in relation to, you know, reporting this book or researching this book. It's been much more sort of subtle and interior.
You talk about Eric sort of calculating when he makes a purchase, how much time, you know, he's not counting up money. He's counting up the amount of time he's had to devote to earn this money to make this purchase. And that is sort of an interesting and perhaps better way to approach it.
And I think really powerful. I mean, we are, you know, the adage time is money, you know, I think is one of the sort of most destructive and flawed, you know, assumptions that we carry in our culture. I mean, if you want, if you really want to understand how untrue that is, I would really encourage you to seek out a terminally ill person and ask them what they think of it. And, you know, that was a real sort of, for me, a really sort of profound moment when I realized that Eric had, you know, when he did decide to make purchases, he wasn't really thinking of it in monetary terms. He was thinking of, you know, this is 3 days of my life. And he is fortunate enough to have those 3 days be spent doing something he loves. You know, the vast majority of Americans are dissatisfied with their jobs. And so they would have to look at it through the lens of 3 days doing something they didn't like. And I think, you know, even that shift in awareness and how we think about the ways in which we're spending our money, which of course in so many instances is our time, which of course is our lives, I think can really lead us to a very different place around our expectations for money.
Let's take a call from Midge in Rochester. Hi, Midge. Thanks for calling.
Hi. It's been interesting listening to this program, to say the least. One of the things that comes to mind is I'm just hearing you talk about the time that it required to purchase, you know, the time that we need to earn that particular money for a particular product. And it's not only that, because in fact, everything that we bring into our lives requires our time and attention as well, whether it be maintain it and to care for it, to clean it, you know, to organize it, to see that it is in its proper place and is in its good and working conditions so we can benefit from it. That too requires time, and which can equate to money. But I was just thinking that I think more of, rather than money as material, you know, what is it, the material products that are available to us, and that's the need calls, you know, makes us need or want or desire more money, just so we can get those material things. And so keeping one's life as simple as one can, you know, the less that we require in that regard. And I tried doing an experiment at the beginning of the year where a few friends of mine in the past hadn't had, took a year off making any purchases. And I thought I would do the same. And I got to January, at the end of January, and couldn't do it. Because I had a birthday that came up, and I didn't have the time to make a gift, and there was the expectation of, you know, bringing something. So
that's a
Yeah.
That's a challenge.
It is a challenge. And what I think what Midge is getting at, in a way, is that we all live under tremendous pressure of certain expectations, societal, cultural expectations around, you know, how we're perceived, what other people think of us, and the ways in which we need to fulfill those expectations.
So is there a certain anti-consumerism, anti-growth message contained in the book, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more implicit than explicit. But yes, you know, to a certain extent there is. I mean, I one of the things I really point out in the book, and I really believe to be true, is that as we have become more wealthy in some aspects, and those aspects generally include the, you know, we've become really wealthy in stuff, in gadgets. You know, everyone's got iPhones and iPods and what, you know, what have you. At the same time, I think we've become somewhat less wealthy in things that really matter. I'm not sure it's a direct exchange, but there is something in that relationship that we, you know, that is creating that exchange.
I mean, iPods and iPhones might be an easy target, but I think you could argue that maybe there's an interconnectedness to being a consumer, to taking part in the consumer economy, in that, you know, what you're doing is putting money back in to help someone else maintain a job in their family. You know the argument.
Sure. I mean, I think that is potentially true to a certain extent. What we need to acknowledge, of course, is that the way in which we've externalized the production of most of the things that fill our lives has all but ensured that there's really no accountability over what's actually happening on that end. So, you know, are we really helping, you know, the people who are assembling these products? Well, perhaps we are in the context of some very, very sort of dysfunctional relationships. But the reality is, of course, we're not really seeing the ultimate ramifications of that production. I mean, that's part of sort of the unconscious economy.
Yeah, I mean, again, you could argue that's another relatively easy target versus, you know, going to your local store to buy things where...
Well, and I think what you're getting at, too, is, you know, this sort of interesting sort of duality of money. I mean, here we're on VPR right now in the midst of a pledge drive, right? Am I going to sit here and argue that people shouldn't support an institution like VPR because it involves money? No. So, again, it's about sort of, you know, understanding the ramifications of our intent for our money.
I wonder if you think, you know, one of the things that came to mind as I was reading your book was this idea that seemed to be in some ascendance about the gross national happiness, you know, measuring things other than the gross domestic product and taking into account these other things. And also, you know, as you were pointing out, we're questioning how the goods are made that we buy, goods particularly made overseas, and what sort of how that money is used and how those workers are paid and treated and all those things. So I wonder if you see us becoming more sensitive to the message of your book these days, or maybe less so because of the economic crisis we've just
I think
through.
More sensitive. Just, you know, absolutely more sense. I mean, the conversations that have emerged in the readings I've done, and for anyone interested, I'll actually be reading at Bear Pond this evening at 7 o'clock. If someone ends up listening to the rebroadcast, they should book it on down because they can still make probably the most interesting part, which will be the conversation. You know, the conversations that are emerging out of these are touching on so many different aspects of life of what it is even to be alive. It really has made me aware of the ways in which money is just connected to almost every aspect of the human experience. I think actually we're becoming much more sensitive, and that makes me actually incredibly hopeful in a way.
Quick comment from Nora in Marlboro, and then maybe one last question. Nora writes, someone who's living on $10,000 a year may be irresponsible in ways other listeners have mentioned, and people who make six-figure incomes are more irresponsible to society as a whole, using too much energy, exploiting those with less money, etc. Nora concludes, the little guy is not the problem, even if he does have to go to the emergency room on society's dollar. You know, one of the things you said earlier in the program really caught my ear, and that is, you know, despite writing the book, doing all the thinking you've done about it, you're not completely free of money worries. It's not as if it's still not, as you pointed out, a discussion you have with your wife.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, the subtitle, you know, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World, is a little tongue-in-cheek, because, of course, I still do worry about money to a certain extent. I can't escape sort of the monetary realm any better than Eric can, any better than most Americans can. It's one of the things I think that is so fascinating about the subject to me is that it is a universal subject. We all need money, and yet it's also highly personal. We all have slightly different circumstances around money. And so I think and it's just incredibly nuanced. There's no – I don't think right or wrong answers, but I think there's a lot of really sort of fertile ground for discussion and exchange of ideas.
Ben Hewitt, it's been great talking to you and thinking about this.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve.
Ben's book is Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. In a moment, the message of Vermont-based organization is taking to the Hispanic teenagers of Los Angeles. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zend in for Jane Lindholm. The Population Media Center is a Vermont nonprofit based in Shelburne. Their focus is on population growth and reproductive health. They get their message across by creating entertainment with an educational angle, which is used in developing countries. But now they've released a TV show aimed at Latino teenagers in Los Angeles.
You're getting Jesse flowers? That little junior better put out.
They're not for Jesse, they're for her mom.
Even better. At least she's not a virgin.
Shut up. Her mom just got out of the hospital.
Hey, I'm just saying, flowers for the mom is like a big step.
So?
Dude, you're wasting your senior year. Best year of your life.
Oh, Jesse's not a waste. You're a waste.
Dig, you have hotties lined up from here to Fontana. You could be having the best time. As long as, you know, you don't make a baby, get a disease.
The TV show is called East Los High, and it's distributed online on Hulu. And Bill Ryerson, who's the president of the Population Media Center, is with us now to talk about it. Welcome, Bill.
Steve, thanks for having me on.
So explain the message of the clip we just heard.
Of course, audience members are being entertained, but at the same time, they're getting a message about protection when they're involved in sexual activity. Hispanic teens in particular have very high rates of unplanned pregnancy as teenagers, and we're modeling characters in this program who will either deal with unwanted pregnancies and the consequences of it, or will take protection to allow themselves to continue in school and go on to college and that type of thing. So It's a subtle way of educating people while entertaining them, without ever telling them what to do. We're just modeling behaviors and showing the consequences.
We mentioned the Population Media Center does these dramas on TV and radio to educate people about these issues, serialized with actors, and they've aired up till now in developing countries. Is it difficult to tread that line between something that's going to entertaining and is going to draw in an audience and something that's not too preachy or moralizing and might turn them off?
The temptation is always to become preachy. And what we find is that's very ineffective. People are not going home at night to be educated with public service announcements and health messages. They're going home at night to be entertained. So we're using highly entertaining, highly suspenseful programs. In the case of East Los High, we have a love triangle, typical soap opera storyline. And in the process of this, the audience is seeing the consequences for the characters of their behavior, but they're not being preached at all. We're never telling them what to do.
You've been doing this for a while, the Population Media Center. How do you measure the effectiveness of this approach?
It varies, of course, from country to country, but in many of the countries where we're working, we're doing nationwide pre- and post-broadcast surveys. So, for example, in Ethiopia, where we've done now 7 radio serial dramas, each of them about 200 episodes, we found just with one of those programs, listeners who comprised half the population went from 14% use of contraception at the baseline to 40% by the end of the program. There was a slight increase among non-listeners, but among listeners, the increase was 2.5 times the increase among non-listeners. And similarly, we found male listeners reported going for HIV testing, which we had modeled in the program, at four times the rate of non-listeners. Female listeners went for testing at three times the rate of non-listeners. So that type of survey is a key measure. The other key measure is clinic exit interviews, where people are coming to get a family planning method or some other service. For example, in northern Nigeria, our most recent program was cited by 67% of family planning clients at clinics in four northern Nigerian states as the reason they had come to the clinic.
It might strike people as odd that an organization in Vermont is putting together messages directed at high school, Hispanic high school students in Los Angeles or teenagers in countries in Africa. How do you go about making sure what you're doing is going to resonate with that population? I mean, are you working with people who know them well?
Yeah. You know, my household language ability is limited. So, and that's true of all of our Vermont staff. So we're not trying to write these programs ourselves. What we're doing is hiring the best writers from any particular community or language group and training them in the methodology that comes out of the telenovela world of Mexico, and they're creating these programs with characters that the population there will resonate with. So, for example, with East Los High, we engaged a very creative telenovela and film producer named Carlos Portugal, and he hired some of the top Hollywood writers from the Hispanic community and top Hispanic actors. We provided training and oversight for the whole process, but they created the storyline, and as you can tell from looking at it on Hulu, it really works. It's become, depending on the day of the week, the number one or number two show on Hulu, so it's doing very, very well.
As you mentioned, this is online via Hulu, not on a television set that somebody's watching. Why did you decide to take that approach?
Among other things, young people are consuming more TV in front of computers than they are in front of television sets. Hulu has 30 million viewers. 4 million of those are paying subscribers who can watch the entire series right away, but the rest are watching it as it rolls out one episode per day, 5 days a week. So right now we're about halfway into this program that's rolling out all of this month.
Are there future projects on tap for the United States?
Yes. We're looking at various options for a successor project, one of which may be a season two on Hulu of this particular program, and then there are others as well that we're in discussion about.
Would they air or be directed at populations other than teenagers in East Los Angeles?
Oh, yes. You know, the reason we started with a program focused on the lives of teens in East L.A. was really twofold. One, they have very high rates of teen pregnancy, and they also suffer from other issues that we're addressing in the program, like obesity. But second, we had, through the help of former president of Telemundo, connected with a very creative person who really ran with this idea. So we started there because that was an opportunity. But we're looking at programs for a whole array of American audiences, from various groups like African Americans to mainstream public.
Bill Ryerson, thanks for talking with us today.
Great to be on with you. Thanks so much.
Bill Ryerson is with the Population Media Center. And that's it for our program today. Tomorrow we'll talk about bears and a new Vermont law that makes it illegal to feed bears, what that change means, as Vermont has seen record number of bears in recent years. Our program was produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Annie Pruitt and Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Steve Zind. Thanks for listening.